all this despite spending some of his youth with Moshe Shaffer. So I think it's a remarkable achievement for him. He's a wonderful speaker, and I first heard of Rabbi Breitovich because, for those of you who attend the English Shul and the Black Shul, whatever you want to call it, Eretz Kenda, I was hearing about all these wonderful shiurim that people who don't usually go to shiurim, they don't enjoy shiurim, we're giving up, it's difficult to say, but things like football matches, to go and listen to Rabbi Breitovich speak. So when we had, it's Simmer's idea that we were going to start a lecture series. We were going to have a sheer stroke lecture. In other words, not everything is going to be necessarily a shiur. As some of you perhaps saw in the flyer that we sent out, the future topics are going to be international law. We have one on psychology or psychiatry. We've got some other stuff lined up as well, but we'll come back to, hopefully, to Rabbi Breitovich if he agrees in the future. We wanted to start with Rabbi Breitovich, first of all, because it is a shiur, we should start with something from Torah, and second of all, because we knew that Rabbi Breitovich was going to speak who would be good, because he's already established a wonderful reputation. He's now teaching in Os Sameach, and we're very proud that he was able to come here tonight. Finally, there is some literature around the tables here on Mavoi Sofum. I'm sure most of you know what Mavoi Sofum is, what we try and do. In Mamash, I'll try and do it in 24 seconds. It's there to help mainly ladies who can't get out of a marriage that they want to get out of. Mavoi Sofum is committed to helping them in any way possible. It's psychological support, financial support, legal support. It's also trying to change the system within the Orthodox framework to try and make sure that the problem is lessened and eventually the problem goes away. I don't want to say more than that, and I'd like to invite Rabbi Yitzchok Breitovich to give our first lecture share in this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Honored to be here, a little overwhelmed by the size of the crowd. I also want to thank our wonderful hosts for making their beautiful home available. When Simmer Friedman approached me about, and Jeremy Brickles approached me about speaking for Mavoi Sofum, although my talk tonight is not about Agunot, I very much wanted to participate. I think the organization has an extremely important purpose. The tragedy of Agunot is a well-known problem in the Jewish world. And if one does not believe in halakha, there's no problem at all. So consequently, talking about non-halakhic solutions would be giving an answer to a non-existent problem. The issue for those who want to keep halakha and to find ways within halakha to liberate really captive women is really a great mitzvah. There is a statement attributed, I believe, to the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, one of the great gedolim of the 16th century in Poland, that said, anyone that is matir aguna, ki ilu bana achat michurvot Yerushalayim, is as if he has built one of the ruins of Jerusalem, which is something, of course, all of us want to do as well. So as a result, if I could contribute in any way to this organization, I'm very, very pleased to do so. But once again, we're not talking about aguna proper. Perhaps that will be a talk for another time. We're talking about a much happier topic, although one that has some tragic undertones as well, and that is the holiday of Hanukkah. Those of you that have come from the United States may have a distant memory of life in the Gola, and you may recall that every year, particularly among assimilated Jews, there's kind of a conflict how to deal with Hanukkah, primarily because of its proximity to a major chag of another religion that occurs around December 25th. Here in Israel, although this is also certainly a major place for Christianity, but it tends to be less dominant in our minds and in our neighborhoods. But the Chilonim, or the secular, or the assimilated Jew, deals with it in two different opposite ways. Sometimes they try to build up Hanukkah by saying Hanukkah is just as good, it's a substitute for December 25th, we have the gift giving and the like. Other times they try to make the opposite point. Hanukkah is not the same as that other holiday, it is not Minat Torah, it doesn't have Kedusha, etc., and they kind of downgrade. The truth, as is often the case, is in the middle. All of us know, of course, Chanukah is not a Yom Tov, it is not a Chag, it does not have the Surim of Malacha, but it is a tremendously important holiday, a tremendously inspirational holiday, and one that speaks exactly to the predicaments of modern man in an assimilated, multicultural society. Because we have to remember the following. We know that based on Daniel and based on other passages in the prophetic writings and the Ketuvim, we know that there are four exiles that the Jewish people are destined to go through. This is after we left Mitzrayim. There is the exile of Babylon, of Babel, that destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Then there was the Galut of Persia, where the story of Purim occurred. And then the Galut of Yavan, when Alexander the Great succeeded to the Persian Empire. And then eventually the Roman Empire, which is called the Galut of Edom. And even though there's no longer a Roman Empire, we are still considered to be in Galut Edom, because the destruction of the Bayit Sheni in the year 70 has not yet been undone, even with the return of the Jewish people to their state. So we have these four Goliuts, and the Maral explains that the four Goliuts are symbolic of four challenges that the Jewish people face by our adversaries. The Galut of Babel is one of persecution and enslavement. That's what Babel did. Babel conquered us. We had been an independent nation. Babel destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Babel exiled our people. That is the Galut of persecution, enslavement, loss of independence. Paras, which was a very short rule, takes it one step further. That is the Galut of genocide. Of course, the outstanding events during Malchus Paras over Eretz Israel, over the Gola, was in fact Haman, Xerath Haman. That's genocide. Hitler, Holocaust. The Galut of Yavan is very, very different. Antiochus was not a Hitler. Antiochus was not a Haman. Antiochus was not interested in physically destroying the Jewish people. Antiochus was interested in cultural assimilation. Antiochus was interested in Hellenism. Antiochus wanted there to be a uniform culture subscribing to the values of philosophy, literature, athleticism, Greek aesthetics, which he had inherited from Alexander the Great. Now, Antiochus had his problems, to be sure. He was a megalomaniac. He gave himself the title Antiochus Epiphanes, which is Greek for Antiochus, the incarnation of the divine. His own subjects, not just the Jews, changed one letter. Instead of Epiphanes, he was known as Epimanes, which is Antiochus the insane. But he was not an anti-Semite in the Hitlerian sense, that, you know, we want to wipe you out no matter what. You know, Hitler didn't care if you were firm or religious, or even, as you know, one of the saints of the Roman Catholic Church is Edith Stein, who died in Auschwitz, but she converted to Catholicism and became a nun, and the Catholic Church canonized her because they say she died as a martyr to her faith, which again is quite odd, because she did not die because she was a Catholic, she died because she was a Jew, and Hitler didn't care one way or the other. But Antiochus was perfectly willing to grant Jews full political and civil rights as long as they stopped sticking out like a sore thumb with their distinct rituals and their monotheism and their Shabbat and their Brit Milah and their Rosh Chodesh. And that's why the Levush says, according to Halacha, a very interesting point. He points out, on Purim, we are obligated to have a meal. We have to have food and drink. We have to have a seudah. There is no obligation to have a seudah on Chanukah. Of course, it's customary, whether it's Sukkot or Latkes or whatever it might be. But there's no chiyuv, there's no obligation to have a seudah. And the Levush explains that Purim, the danger we faced was to our guf, our physical survival, in a physical way, by eating and drinking. Chanukah, there really was no danger to our physical survival. Granted, there was a war, but the war was only in response to our resistance to the spiritual assimilation. The danger of Chanukah was cultural, spiritual assimilation to a value system that to some degree was antagonistic to the Torah. And therefore, since the sakana was beruchniot, the sakana was spiritual, we commemorate and express our gratitude in a spiritual way, hadlakat nevot. Like this is exactly Levush. So, Once again, therefore, Bavel represents enslavement, persecution. Paras represents genocide, physical endangerment. Yavan represents cultural assimilation. What is Edom? Edom is the longest of all the Galiot. We're still in Galut Edom. By the way, I just want to put a little parenthetical aside, which is a talk for a whole other time. There are commentators like the Ibn Ezra who posit there's actually a fifth Galut, and that's the Galut of Yishmael. And indeed, we can experience that as well. But for whatever reason, Chazal do not deal with Yishmael as a separate Malchut. They consider Galut Edom to be the final Galut. So what is Galut Edom? The Maharal explains, Galut Edom is simply an intensification of all of the trials and tribulations of the preceding Galut. And depending on the time and the place, you will have a different manifestation. So in Galut Edom, there is the persecution and enslavement of Babylonia. In the Galut Edom, there is the genocide of Haman. In the Galut Edom, there is the assimilation of Yavan. So as a result, you can look at different countries, different times, different places. Sometimes you're in the Bavel of Galut Edom. Sometimes you're in the Paras of Galut Edom, like the Holocaust. And other times you're in the Yavan of Galut Edom. So if we were to identify what stage of Galut Edom is most of the Jewish world in, now granted, there are still pockets where there's persecution and enslavement. I mean, there are Jews, for example, in Syria. One of my students, I couldn't believe it, told me that he's going to Syria this week to visit his uncle. I don't know exactly, I guess with an American I don't know exactly how he's going to do it, if his passport has an Israeli visa, but he'll find some way of doing it. That's persecution. We have genocide. There are people alive today who still remember the awesome Churban of Europe. But for most of us, the main issue, even in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, is not physical survival. And it's not persecution. But certainly it is the values of secular society, the values of Western culture, that kind of take us away from being Jewish. And this is indeed a great, great nisayon, a great, great trial. Because the way God set up the world, it's not going to be the case that if I eat a ham sandwich or something, lightning is going to strike me dead. For whatever reason, God created a world of free choice, of free will, and we normally don't suffer immediate consequences when we abandon the Torah. And the pressures are very, very great. Baruch Hashem, maybe not so much here, but I work with kids who come from college campuses, in which they might be the only Shomer Shabbat Jew among 1,000 other Jews, etc. And the lesson of Hanukkah is to have the courage to stand up for the Torah, even if the vast majority of your society, including the Jewish society, do not necessarily accept those values. And here I want to discuss the history a little bit, because the history of Hanukkah is very, very significant. If we ask most people, why do we have a holiday of Hanukkah? They will tell you, because a little jar of oil was found that could only burn for one day, and it burned for 8 days, and we celebrate the miracle of Hanukkah because of that eight days. Now, here is the problem with that. The Maharal writes that we never make holidays just because miracles happened, unless they involve the saving of the Jewish people. I mean, there are many miracles. For example, Elisha in the book of Malachim encountered a widow who was very poor, and the widow had a jar of oil, and that's all she had. So Elisha gave her a bracha that this jar would not get depleted, and she could keep on, right, same thing, right, etc. We don't have a holiday, Widow's Day, or whatever it is, when Elisha HaNavi gave that bracha. The Maharal says, we don't make Yomim Tovim just because miracles happened. The Maharal says the following. The reason why we have a holiday of Hanukkah is because there was a war against the Yavanim. The Yavanim got custody of the Beit HaMikdash, they contaminated it, they desecrated it, they sacrificed pigs on the altar, they built houses of prostitution. They turned the Beit HaMikdash into a house of Avodah Zarah. Most of the Jewish population went along with the Hellenizing tendencies of Antiochus' Gezeirot. And when the small, courageous group called the Hashmonaim, who were regarded as fanatics and obstructionists, even by their fellow Jews, when they stood up for the cause of the Torah, and they were victorious, and they established a Jewish state based on the teachings of the Torah and the freedom to keep the Torah, Chazal enacted a holiday to commemorate the liberation of the temple and the establishment of the ability to keep the Torah. It was not because of Hadlakat HaNerot. Now, Hadlakat HaNerot got incorporated as an observance for a reason I will discuss separately, but Hanukkah represents, literally, Hanukkah means dedication, and in a very literal way, it is celebrating the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. According to the Book of the Maccabees, the Beit HaMikdash remained under Greek domination for 3 years, starting on the 25th of Kislev. It's amazing. The 25th of Kislev was the day that the Yevanim were nichnasu la'eichal, and 3 years later, exactly on the 25th of Kislev, the Hashmonaim entered the Beit HaMikdash. I guess the closest thing in our own memory would be the Six-Day War, Harabayit Biyadenu. This is much greater. This is not just getting, you know, the Harabayit. This is getting the Beit HaMikdash and purifying the Beit HaMikdash. And in fact, the Maral's understanding is the following. The Maral's understanding is that the miracle of the oil did not occur at the end of the armed struggle. If you look at the Book of the Maccabees, and I'll discuss what is the Book of the Maccabees in a moment. If you look at the Book of the Maccabees, you actually discover that gaining the Beit HaMikdash was not the end of the struggle against the Yevanim. There was a civil war, not a civil war, there was a war against the Yevanim. Antiochus was still in charge of most of Eretz Israel. And this war continued for almost 25 years. The gaining of the Beit HaMikdash was a beachhead. It was a major spiritual victory. But the only thing the Hashmonaim had was the Har HaBayit and some of the area of Yerushalayim. But it was like, you know, West Berlin in the middle of East Germany, surrounded by hostile enemies. And they fought for 25 years. Now, listen to this. Listen to how this changes the perspective of the candles. In the middle of this war, they find this little cruse of oil that miraculously burns for 8 days. Think about what that miracle meant for that small group of people. They're fighting against the greatest army of the ancient world at the time. They do not have the support of their co-religionists. Many Jews thought them fanatic. Many Jews thought them misguided. Many Jews, perhaps most of the Jews, went with the assimilation plan. It made more sense. Now, this was around approximately 2nd century before the Common Era, around 185 B.C. B.C.E. So they're just like we would say today, why don't you live in the 21st century? So I guess they said, why don't you live as a 2nd century B.C.E. person? What type of, backwards person are you? In the life, you know, get with the agenda. And it's understandable that people sometimes feel hopeless. They feel despondent. They feel there's no point in going on. What's the point of fighting yet another day when inevitably we're going to be crushed? What does God show? God shows that. Here you have one little bit of oil. The oil logically should not last more than a day. But you do what you can. And then God blesses your efforts beyond what you thought possible. It's actually historically much more meaningful to place this at the beginning of the struggle than at the end of the struggle. Because God is giving them that message of hope. God is giving them that message of not giving up. God is giving them the spiritual message that light will overcome darkness, even if the odds seem to be totally the opposite way. Don't give up. Keep on going. And Chazal took that miracle to commemorate the inner meaning of Hanukkah. So the holiday of Hanukkah is about the triumph and about the victory and about the dedication of the temple. And the Rambam even says about the establishment of a Jewish state, which has an interesting repercussion to Yom HaTzimut. The Rambam actually says that the purpose of, again, I'm not gonna get into hot potato. You know, this is the famous, when you interview for a rabbinical position in the States, so the question, do you say hello in your mouth? Okay. So I said, well, I can do either way. That's what they asked. They once said, Lyndon Johnson says it, in the 1920s, he was teaching in the public schools. So in fundamentalist Texas, you know, the question was, do you believe in evolution? The right answer was no in those days. So he said, well, I can teach it either way. You know, what do you want? Which way do you want to go? But again, it's actually a very critical passage, because the Rambam says in Hanukkah, the Hallel of Hanukkah is about the establishment of Shilton, the Israel. But be it as it may, the idea of the miracle of the candles is not the reason for the Hanukkah, but it's that eternal message that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows the powers of light to vanquish darkness. As long as you do as much as you can do, even if you think it's pointless, even if you think there's no reason to go on, and that was the message that gave them the courage to keep on fighting against insurmountable odds, the Derech HaTeva. And that actually explains why a famous question, and this answers a number of questions. Number one, it answers probably one of the most famous questions in halakhic literature, the very famous question of Rav Yosef Kairo, the Beis Yosef. Right, everyone knows this question. If there was a miracle that they found enough oil for one day, and it burns for 8 days, then the miracle of Hanukkah is only 7 days, so why do we have a holiday of 8 days? Now, the Beis Yosef gives three answers. I know that there are at least 500 answers to this question, because I have actually seen a sefer that gives 500 answers to this question. I'm not going to go over all 500 answers. I don't know all 500 answers, but some answers are the miracle is they found the oil, the miracle is they looked for the oil. Some say they divided the oil into 8 portions. They only put 1/8 of a day's oil because they wanted it to last, and that burnt the whole day. Many, many answers. But according to the Maharal, the question doesn't start. Because he says, the reason Hanukkah is 8 days is because dedication ceremonies of the Beit HaMikdash are 8 days. Because when Moshe inaugurated the Mishkan, it was an 8-day dedication ceremony. Hanukkah is 8 days because of Chanukat HaBayit. Right? Not because of the miracle of the oil. Okay? This answers another question as well. One of the questions people always ask is that on one hand, we celebrate Hanukkah with the Neirot. On the other hand, in the Al HaNisan prayer, which we recite both in the Shemona Esrei and in Birkat HaMazon, there is no reference at all to the Neirot. Now, it does say, Hidliku Neirot B'chatzrot Kadshecha, but that's just referring that, you know, we were able to light the menorah again. It does not refer to any miracle in connection with the menorah. Why does the Al HaNisan only talk about the victory of the few over the many, the pure over the impure, the righteous over the evil? It doesn't mention the Neirot. The Maharal says, because the real celebration is the triumph of the Jewish people. The Neirot was the mechanism by which God gave us the chizuk to go on. But that's not the celebration. That's just the spiritual message to keep on going. And the Al HaNisan, therefore, deals primarily with the Nitzachon in a spiritual sense of light over darkness, purity over impurity. And that's a great message in the long, dark nights of the winter. And the world seems dark in many, many ways, literally and figuratively. This light pierces that darkness. That's the message we have to take. Now, here's the thing. Those of you that have read George Orwell may recall his book, Animal Farm. And Animal Farm is a parody of the Communist Revolution of 1917. And the story there basically is the animals decided to revolt against human oppression. And they overthrow the farmers that are oppressing them. And they have someone else that's their leader. And the story basically goes that eventually the animal who overthrew the human oppressors becomes even worse than the human oppressors that he overthrew. And this is, of course, the history of many, many revolutions. It's certainly the history of the Russian Revolution, where, you know, you overthrow the Tsar and you get a Lenin and then a Stalin. Not too much of an improvement. the French Revolution, you overthrow King's Louis, and you get Robespierre. American Revolution might be a notable exception, and of course, if you describe Israel 1948 as a revolution, although technically it was not, Baruch Hashem, we also have much more of an improvement. But it is undoubtedly the case that in many, many revolutions, you become the very enemy that you're trying to overthrow. And this is the sad part of the Hanukkah story. The Hanukkah story began with magnificent promise, or at least the end of the war, in terms of a Jewish state, independence, the primacy of Torah, the ability to vanquish even huge numbers, as the Alamitim say. But one of the cruel ironies of history is that the Hashmonaim became the very Hellenists and assimilationists that they were fighting against. Because what happened was, as I said, the Beit HaMikdash was regained by the Hashmonaim in around 185 BCE. There were military activities for another 20 years. After 20 or so years, the Book of the Maccabees records that Shimon, who was the last surviving Maccabee, the last surviving of the Hashmonaim, was proclaimed to be Nasi Yisrael, which is generally understood as a royal title. I'll discuss exactly why Nasi and not Melech. It's very interesting. And a Jewish state was proclaimed, and in the official proclamation it says, Ad to Urim V'Tumim, until the Mashiach comes and gives us the prophetic mechanism of the Urim V'Tumim, which presumably means the Mashiach ben David comes. The Ramban writes in the Parshas Vayechi that all of the Hashmonaim were Tzadikei Elyon. They were all righteous, saintly people. In fact, Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests that is why Shimon took the title Melech. He only took the title Nasi, because the Ramban writes it was forbidden for the Hashmonaim to proclaim themselves as kings, because kingship and monarchy belonged to the tribe of Yehuda. Now the Ramban says it was an Aveira for the Hashmonaim to create a monarchy, but Rav Yaakov wants to suggest perhaps that's why he didn't take the title Melech. But be it as it may, after the next generation, and the Hasmonean dynasty lasted for around a little more than 100 years, eventually they degenerated into Hellenists, into Sadducees, into Tzdukis, into persecutors of the Chachamim, into deniers of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The one notable exception was the one female Hasmonean monarch, and that's Shomam Tzion Hamalka. They had a street in her honor, and she in fact was a very righteous woman who befriended the Chachamim and gave them much strength and support. But other than that, the Hashmonaim they basically destroyed the very purposes of which they fought. Politically, it was also a failure, because eventually the Romans came in and took over the Hasmonean monarchy by the invitation of the Hashmonaim themselves. There were feuding between two brothers, Ahorcanus and Aristobulus, as to who should assume monarchy. There was a civil war between their respective supporters. One of them had the bright idea to invite the famous Roman general, second to Caesar, Pompey, to kind of come in and help him out. And once Pompey arrives with several hundred thousand troops, Pompey decides that Israel is a nice place to take a summer vacation, and he decides to simply take over the country. In fact, that's actually the literal meaning of the idea that the Second Temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. Sinat Chinam is actually referring to the Roman presence in Eretz Yisrael came because of the Sinat Chinam between two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. So it turns out the following. Hanukkah had such magnificent potential politically, creating an independent Jewish state, spiritually defeating the forces of assimilation and creating a Torah society. But it culminated in a tremendous failure. Politically, the Hasmonean state was simply decimated and destroyed by the Romans, who installed Herod and various other people. Spiritually, the Hashmonaim themselves became Hellenists, like the comic strip character Pogo. We have met the enemy and he is us. We are our own enemy. So this explains an interesting, history helps you a lot here. This explains an interesting point. By the time the Mishnah was written, a famous observation, the Mishnah was written by Rav Yehuda HaNasi approximately the year 200 of the Common Era. Now this is already after, way after the Hashmonaim, and it's after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, because it was destroyed in the year 70, 68, or 70. And this is 130 years. This is after the Bar Kokhba report. And one of the great mysteries is the Mishnah, which is supposed to be the totality of the oral law, the Mishnah is aware of the holiday of Chanukah, but it barely mentions it. It barely mentions the holiday of Chanukah. Unlike Purim, which has a whole tractate, Masechet Megillah, Chanukah is mentioned twice in the Mishnah. And in both cases, it is a peripheral, very incidental mention. One is in Masechet Bava Kamma, which is talking about a very odd case that has nothing to do with Chanukah at all, but it's used to illustrate a principle. The Shaila there is, if you have a camel, and on the camel's back there are long strands of flax, and the camel is walking in the street, and the flax gets ignited by a lantern outside of the store, and unbeknownst to everybody, the camel keeps on walking and sets a house on fire. So the question is, who is chayav for the destruction of the house? The owner of the camel, because that he brought the fire to the building, or the owner of the lantern? So the Talmud says, the Mishnah says the following rule. If the lantern is inside the store, and the flax got ignited from inside, the store owner is not responsible, because he's allowed to keep his light there, and therefore the gamal, the bal ha-gamal is chayav. If it's outside, you're not supposed to keep your light in Rishut HaRabim, so the owner of the light is Chayav. Rav Yehuda Omer, but if the light was near Chanukah, since you're supposed to light your Nerot Chanukah outside, they didn't have the plastic cases in those days, so the Baal HaChanut is Pator, because he lit Birshut, he lit. Whereas the, so the whole law of Chanukah is like that little thing about the camel setting fire. Another mention of Chanukah is in Tractate Bikurim, that basically says you're supposed to bring your Bikurim after Shavuot to Sukkot, but B'dieved you can bring it until Chanukah. That's all it says. But Chanukah is 100% de-emphasized in the Mishnah. People ask the question, why is Chanukah so de-emphasized in the Mishnah? Well, you can give a lot of answers. One answer is, Chanukah is not a politically correct holiday when Eretz Yisrael is under Roman domination, particularly after the Romans crushed the Jewish nation, both in the Judaic War, which culminated in 70, and the Bar Kokhba revolt. Right? We light our candles. Some Roman guy goes by and say, hey, why are you lighting your candles? He says, oh, well, we have this holiday that celebrates removal of foreign domination over the land of Israel. Not, it's not politically correct. So Chanukah kind of had a low profile. In fact, that's why the Gemara says that at some point there was a sakana to light Hanukkah candles outside, and they moved it inside. What's the sakana? The sakana was because the Romans construed the lighting of Nevot as a call to rebellion. That is one reason. But there's another reason, and that is, one might suggest that the Jewish leadership had a genuine ambivalence about the holiday of Hanukkah, because all of the objectives of the Hashmonaim culminated in failure. Spiritually, they degenerated into the very enemy they were trying to overthrow. Politically, it didn't pass. And that is why, indeed, in the Gemara, which does talk about Chanukah a little bit, you find much more emphasis on the Nechot than the Milchama. In fact, one might go going back to what I said before. The Al HaNisim, which was written contemporaneously with the miracle, emphasizes the Milchama because that was the bigger thing. But in the light of history, the Nevot are like all you're left with, which is a very important message. But the message, I suppose, is a little more balanced and disheartening. The message is, God gives you the strength and the opportunity to accomplish wonderful things. The counterbalance is, but you can still mess it up. So it's kind of a, there is something sobering about Hanukkah, along with the great beauty and message. Okay, so this is kind of putting it in historical perspective. Chanukah is not about the miracle of the oil, but Chanukah is the message that the miracle of the oil teaches us to have courage to persevere, but at the same time be aware that Kol Yisrael can sometimes mess up the greatest gifts that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us. This, I think, has a sobering message for living in Eretz Yisrael as well, about having Eretz Yisrael, coming back to the land, having estates, being able to do all that we can do. It's such a wonderful gift, an amazing opportunity, really a miracle in a lot of ways. But once again, we can do all sorts of things that make it a more difficult situation. And there are no guarantees. HaKadosh Baruch Hu entrusts. In fact, it's reminiscent of a famous midrash that Jewish environmentalists often quote. But it's a beautiful midrash where God, makes the Garden of Eden, and he puts Adam in the Garden of Eden, and he says, I'm giving you this beautiful garden. Just make sure you don't mess it up. And of course, Adam got expelled from that beautiful garden. Now, let me just say a few words about the historical sources of Chanukah. I've been mentioning the Book of the Maccabees in some circles. Oh, they're not here, but in some circles, the Book of the Maccabees is like you're talking about the New Testament or something. Let me just emphasize, and again, I apologize if this is familiar to all of you. That is, we, of course, have the Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, and the period of the Tanakh ends before the Yavanim comes. And it was the last event that is recorded in Tanakh occurred during the Persian rule. Cyrus Coleridge announces that Jews can return. We have the Shivat Sion. We have the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, etc. But Alexander is right after the period of Tanakh. Right, the Greek period is not covered in the Tanakh at all. And we know that Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim are called divinely inspired books. Now, the Torah is a little different than Nevi'im and Ketuvim. The Torah was a word-for-word dictation. God told Moshe, some say the last eight verses Yeshua, but God told Moshe exactly what to write. Bereshit bara Elokim. Nevi'im and Ketuvim are a little different. Without getting into the difference between Nevi'im and Ketuvim, God did not dictate on a word-for-word basis what Yeshayahu should write. Rather, Yeshayahu has prophecies. He has visions. And then, in a state of divine inspiration, he commits those visions to words. So the Ruach HaKodesh of Nevi'im and Ketuvim is different than the Torah. It is not a word-for-word dictation. But nevertheless, these are books that are divinely inspired. Many other books were written that the Chachamim made a decision were not divinely inspired, and they were gathered in a body that is commonly known by the Greek term the Apocrypha, which either means the hidden books or the excluded books, and in Hebrew by the somewhat sinister title Svarim Chitzamim, the outside books. But the problem with the Apocrypha is this. There are a number of different reasons why books were excluded, and the reasons are not the same. Some books were excluded because they did contain ideas that Chazal regarded as heretical and against the Torah Shebal Peh. And of course, even some of the books that made the canon, there was some thought of excluding them. There was some thought about excluding the book of Yechezkel, because there are many passages in Yechezkel that seem to violate the halachot of the Torah. Shir HaShirim almost didn't make it, because it was seen as semi-pornographic, etc. But other books, were deemed to be heretical, especially because this was the period of time where you had a lot of movements, like similar to Christianity, but a lot of Dead Sea Scroll people and the like, which had different types of views. So those books are kind of heresy books. But a lot of books, like the Book of the Maccabees, were not excluded because they were heretical. They were simply excluded because they were not regarded as divinely inspired, and this was after the period of prophecy. As a result, the Book of the Maccabees is considered within our tradition as a perfectly acceptable book of history, although it is not a sacred book of history. So if you dropped the Book of Maccabees on the floor, you would not have to kiss it, so to speak. But it's perfectly legitimate, and Rishonim, like Rashi and other sources, do utilize the Book of the Maccabees. So when you say the Apocrypha is something that religious Jews don't look at, it really depends on what part of the Apocrypha and for what purposes. Now, the Book of the Maccabees In fact, there are four books of the Maccabees. It goes by two names, either Sefer HaMaccabim or Sefer HaShmonaim. Those are interchangeable names. There's actually four books of the Maccabees, but for historical purposes, it's only Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2 that give the history of the rebellion of the Jews against the Greek oppression in Eretz Israel. Maccabees 3 and 4 are really philosophical treatises that kind of use some of the stories of the Hashmonaim just to make philosophical points. They are not intrinsically historical. Now, what's fascinating is that both Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2 talk about the desecration of the temple and the regaining of the temple and the establishment of the Jewish state. But neither of those works even mentions the miracle of the Megillah. And in fact, it's very fascinating. According to Maccabees 1, and the Maral, who did probably didn't see the book of the Maccabees, was Mechaven to Maccabees 1. According to Maccabees 1, the reason why Hanukkah was 8 days is because dedication of the Beit HaMikdash is 8 days, which is what Maral says later. And according to Maccabees 2, even a stranger idea is advanced. Maccabees 2 says that Hanukkah was an 8-day festival because that year they missed Sukkot in the Beit HaMikdash. And Sukkot in the Beit HaMikdash is an 8-day festival because you have Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret. And they thought that Hanukkah would be a makeup for Sukkot. And in Maccabees 2, it is recorded that they sat in Sukkot and they took Lulav and Etrog. Now, this is not a halakhically valid conclusion, right? Sukkot, you cannot, I mean, you can make up for Pesach, Pesach Sheni, you can't make up for Sukkot. So Chazal kind of dropped the ball. They never mentioned that one again. They kind of let it lie. Chazal don't condemn the Apocrypha, but they don't quote from it either, so they kind of just let it lie. But Lefi Aniyat Dati, I'd want to suggest there is one little remnant in Chazal to the ancestral connection between Hanukkah and Sukkot. You know, just like when you try to delete a pro-computer program, right, there's always something that's left. Chazal were not in favor of connecting Hanukkah to Sukkot, but something survived, but it only survived in the view of Beit Shammai. Mm-hmm. There's a famous argument how you light the Hanukkah candles. Mm-hmm. Beit Hillel says you go up, which is what we do. Mm-hmm. Beit Shammai says you go down. And one of the reasons that the Gemara gives for Beit Shammai is you want to commit the Neirot Hanukkah correspond to the Karbanot of Sukkot, the 70 bulls that go down. Now the Gemara is extremely enigmatic. What on earth would the connection be? And in fact, I'll share with you later some Hasidic thoughts on what the connection is. But if you want to be a cold-hearted historian, one might suggest this is a vestigial remainder and reminder of the Book of the Maccabees that correlated Hanukkah with Sukkot by indicating that Hadlakat HaNerot should follow the pattern of Sukkot. So even though Chazal never picked this up in any explicit way, one might suggest that it survives in that particular way. So what's interesting is neither of them mention Neirot. The first mention of the Nes of the Neirot appears in a document called Megillat Ta'anit. Now Megillat Ta'anit is very interesting. It actually is the first halachic work on the oral law that was committed to writing. It is earlier than the Mishnah. The Mishnah, as I indicated, was completed approximately the year 200 of the Common Era. Megillat Ta'anit is around 100 years earlier during the Roman domination of Eretz Yisrael, the tail end of the Hashmonaim and the Roman domination. And Megillat Ta'anit is essentially a calendar listing of the festive days that you're not allowed to fast or eulogize. And it mentions a lot of days that we don't have today. These are different, you know, we think the Yom Tov schedule is big today. In the time of the Second Temple, they celebrated all sorts of different events. The only Megillat Ta'anit days that we still celebrate are Hanukkah and Purim. We don't celebrate all these other days, but Megillat Ta'anit gives the story of the Pach HaShemen. Now, think about this. The actual story of Hanukkah occurred in 185 BCE. Megillat Ta'anit is around 30 BCE. It is over 100 years after the Hanukkah story. But once again, By that time, the Hashmonaim have already failed. The Romans have already come in. So the only thing to emphasize is the Melech. Now again, I'm not, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying, as some secular people say, that the story of the Neirot is a made-up story. Chas v'shalom. We, of course, believe it was such a miracle. I'm just suggesting that it had not been the primary focus of the Chag till the Hashmonaim degenerated and failed, and then Chazal looked at different aspects of the Chag to come to the forefront, which is perfectly fine, because different things are emphasized at different times based on what turns out to be enduring. Right? People at the time might think something is of major importance. It turns out not to be, and you look at another aspect. Right? That's why there is a shift between Milchama and Mehotz, which occurred between the Maccabee books and the Gilat Anit, and that's carried forth in the Mishnah, and it's carried forth in the Gemara as well, which does not emphasize. The Rambam, on the other hand, kind of goes back to the Milchama by talking about the Simcha of Hanukkah is the return of sovereignty to the Jewish state. Right? So the Rambam kind of goes back to that idea. So one difference between Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2 is the reason for the 8 days of Hanukkah. Maccabees 1 says Chanukat HaBayit. Maccabees 2 says because of Sukkot, and the Maral was Mechaved to Maccabees 1. I want to mention another emphasis as well. And once again, it's fascinating how different observers view different things as important. Maccabees 1 very much emphasizes the simcha of political independence. It goes through the wars in great detail, and it emphasizes political independence. Maccabees 2 focuses much more on the spiritual nitzachon of being able to keep the Torah. So both were true. Both were true. But Maccabees 1, again, both books are religious books. Both books emphasize that Hashem gave us Yeshua. They're both religious books of Ma'aminim. But the simcha of the author of Maccabees 1 was the political simcha. The simcha of the author of Maccabees 2, different author, was the primacy of Torah. And that is why Maccabees 2 has many stories of martyrdom, which do not appear in Maccabees 1. Because as far as Maccabees 1 is concerned, martyrdom was a failure. Gee, Jews had to get killed. But Maccabees 2 glorifies the martyr as much as the military victor, because the martyr had the spiritual victory of not giving in. So it's interesting that you have this different emphasis. Right, so I've mentioned so far the two books of the Maccabees, which were written roughly contemporaneously with the Hasmonean state, which, as I say, was around 25 years after the Hanukkah liberation of the temple. Then we have Megillat Tanit, that was written 100 years before the Churban. Then we have the Mishnah, we have the Talmud. Let me mention two other historical sources about Hanukkah. One is Josephus. Now Josephus, Yosef ben Matisyahu, right, he has the street in Geula, although he probably wouldn't like Geula that much. Josephus was a very, very interesting guy, and exactly how we view Josephus is very controversial to this very day. Josephus was a Kohen, Yosef Batzel Kohen. He claims to have been a Talmudic or a Mishnaic, there was no Talmud then, but he claims to have been a great, brilliant student of the Oral Law, although that does not come across in his books at all. You get no sense that he knew anything, but he claims that he knew all of these Torah Shebal Peh. He was a general in the Jewish army in the war against Rome, and he rose relatively rapidly, but for a variety of reasons, he surrendered to the Romans, and he became the equivalent of a Benedict Arnold, spending the war years, the war against Yerushalayim, spending those years in Rome, and he wrote what is still the most complete history of the Judean War, the Jewish War, the war against Rome, and he tries to portray, well, he's in a very precarious position, you have to kind of feel for Josephus, because he does care for the Jewish people, and he does want to paint them in a positive way, but he also doesn't want to be too insulting to Rome. After all, they are his benefactors, they are taking care of him, he was even living in Vespasian's house, etc. And as a result, he creates this impression, which is actually borne out in some sources in Chazal, that the vast majority of the Jewish people didn't want to rebel against Rome, and this war was started by a bunch of fanatics who were not representative of Am Yisrael. And then on the other side, he said, you know, Titus isn't as bad as people think. No, Titus didn't want to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. He was forced to do it by these soldiers that kept on putting pressure. He's trying to walk both ways. But the truth of the matter is, as they say, he's a very controversial person. Was he a person who cared about the Jewish people and felt that this war was so destructive that surrender was the only way out? And by the way, that's not such a heretical position. That was the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who felt exactly the same way. Do you remember this, the Gemara in Gittin?
Why? Oh,
huh?
Why?
Because he felt that Rome would crush the Jewish people, as they did, and there would be no way to survive if we would simply make peace with the Romans. We could have our Beit HaMikdash and serve Hashem. Political independence was not justifiable. Now, once again, Rabbi Akiva. See, you know, we look at our Chachamim as ivory tower sages who learn all day. But you have to understand, look at the vital issues here. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was a pacifist who believed you cannot wage war with Rome. Years later, Rabbi Akiva was a great supporter of the Bar Kokhba revolt. In other words, our great Gedolim were so divided over this issue. And in retrospect, I'm not going to say who was right, but in retrospect, we do know that both times the Romans delivered a crushing devastation on the Jewish people. So whether we look at Josephus as a wise person who understood the appropriate strategy, or whether you look at him as a traitor and a quisling and an appeaser and a betrayer of his people, the jury is out. He's actually a fascinating personality in that way. And everything he says has to be viewed with a grain of salt because he's writing on a tightrope. He wants to say nice things about the Jews, but he doesn't want to antagonize the Romans. He's living in Rome. But be it as it may, he does give us the complete blow-by-blow account of the Roman War. But in addition to that, he tries to go back historically. Actually, he writes a history from Briyat Olam. He summarizes the Tanakh as well. But he gives the story of Hanukkah. And he does not even mention, not only does he not mention the miracle of the oil, he does not even mention that Hanukkah is celebrated by lighting menorahs. He is very peculiar. In fact, he's the first one who notes. Right, so Josephus wrote this around the year 90, 20 years after the Korban, before the Mishnah, right, after the Gilat Tanit, before the Mishnah. Josephus is the first one who says that Hanukkah is called, the Jewish people call Hanukkah, Chag Ha'urim, the holiday of lights. He's the first one that uses that title, but he doesn't know why it's called Chag Ha'urim. And he says, well, maybe they lit bonfires when they achieved military victory. Now, if you ask any kindergartner, why is Hanukkah Chag Ha'urim? They're going to say, because you light candles. How did Josephus not know that? Was there an assumption? Well, maybe in Rome they didn't light candles because of the political reasons I mentioned before. On the other hand, Josephus did not come to Rome until he was already, you know, in his 30s or 40s. I mean, they didn't light candles when he was growing up in Eretz Yisrael. You know, I don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. But you do have these sources. The two books of the Maccabees, Megillat Tanith, the very sparse mention in the Mishnah, Josephus. I'm going to mention one final source. And that is, there is something that is called Megillat Antiochus, or Megillat Chashmonaim, or Megillat Hanukkah. It's all the same thing. This is like a Megillah. It's like the story of Hanukkah in the Megillah form. Many synagogues had the minhag of reading it on Hanukkah publicly, even with a bracha. Most Batei Knesiot do not do it today. It's not a widespread minhag, although I don't know if any of you have such a minhag, but some sidurim actually have called Megillat Hanukkah. Now, Megillat Hanukkah is basically a summary of Hanukkah. It's not that big. It's Megillat Hanukkah would be like 5 chapters. It's not a very big document. One of the unusual things in Megillat Hanukkah is that Yehuda HaMakkabee is given almost a non-existent role. He's killed in the first battle, and he's not at all the hero of any of the Hanukkah stories. It's kind of an odd little fetch. But when was Megillat Hanukkah written? You have such a tremendous diversity of opinion. There are opinions who say it is the earliest chronicle of the Hanukkah story, written at the time of the event itself, even earlier than Maccabees. That's one extent. There is another view that says it was written in the Middle Ages, like, you know, the 1000s, the 11th century, and it is just a summary with some changes of everything earlier, and it is not a primary work of history at all. It is a derivative work. So I don't have proof one way or the other. Dr. Neil Sperber in his Sefer Min Hagei Yisrael, the fifth volume of the set, is devoted totally to Hanukkah. Some very, very interesting essays. So he does have an essay on Megillat Antiochus and what it is. So it's either the best historical source or it's the worst historical source, depending on how you date it. It's dated in, as they say, extremes, dating from 185 BCE all the way to the 1000s of CE. Right? So this is kind of the hidden, little bit of the hidden history of Hanukkah. And again, as I say, it's interesting to see how a Chag undergoes a certain amount of evolution, not in the sense of stories being made up, this is not the way a Maamin approaches this, but in the sense of different aspects of the Chag being emphasized at different times. Now, I want to go back a little bit and maybe switch gears from maybe the academic or the quasi-academic historian to focus a little bit on the spiritual meaning of this. And that is, we've already mentioned the Machloket, Beit Shammai, and Beit Hillel, if Hanukkah, we light 8 candles and we go down, or we start with 1 candle and we go up. And of course, this is a Machlokes, Beit Shammai, and Beit Hillel, and the halacha always is according to Beit Hillel. We always know that. By the way, I want to give you a cheap little answer. You know why some people say this question, why Hanukkah is 8 days and not 7? Some say the following, and you have to get a mental picture here. If Hanukkah would be 7 days, on the 4th day, you wouldn't know if you're following Beit Hillel or Beit Shammai. Because here's how it would work. Day 1, 7, like Shammai, if Hanukkah would be 7 days. 7, 1. Day 2, 6, 2. Day 3, 5, 3. Day 4, 4, 4. So, since the Chachamim wanted to ensure that you would always make it clear that you're following Beit Hillel, you got to make it 8 days. That way it's 8, 1, 7, 2, 6, 3, 5, 4, right? 4, 5, right? So, in fact, they even say Hanukkah, the Derech Remez, is Chet Nehot V'Halacha K'Beit Hillel. Meaning to say, you light for 8 days to ensure the halakha is like, yeah, that's a drush, but each other halakha is like Beit Hillel. But, being as it may, going back to that Machloket, the Gemara gives 2 reasons for the argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. 2 reasons. Reason number 1 is, Beit Shammai says you light based on the number of days that are coming towards you. On the first day I have 8 days coming towards me, on the last day I only have 1 day, right? So I light based on the days that are hitting me. Beit Hillel says, you light based on the days that are behind you, including the day that you're lighting. Now, l'chari, that's not much of an explanation. That's just restating what you're doing, right? It's not an explanation. Now, the second reason, which I already mentioned, is Beit Shammai connects Hanukkah to the Parim of Sukkot, and Beit Hillel says, Ma'alin v'kodesh, we want to go up in Kedusha, which seems to me that's a relatively easy thing to understand. But I want to give you a brief explanation of each of those explanations of the Gemara. Explanation number 1 is Beit Shammai looks at the days that are hitting you, which go down. Beit Hillel looks at the days that you've experienced, which are going up. What would that mean, and how is that an explanation? So here's the following. All of us know, every student of Halakha knows, that generally speaking, When you have an argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, as a general rule, Beit Hillel is strict and Beit Shammai is lenient. Now, the Chara, I apologize. Beit Shammai is strict and Beit Hillel is lenient. Yeah, that's right. Now, the Chara, a machloket like this has nothing to do with leniency or strictness, because you're going to have the same number of candles one way or the other, just which way you're going. But Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin says, conceptually it is related, in the following way. Rashi says in the beginning of Bereshit that originally God wanted to create the world with Midat HaDin, But he saw that the world could not exist with strict din. So he combined rachamim and din. Which means, in a Platonic sense, the ideal world is a world of strict din. But the imperfect realization of the defective human personality requires a certain concession called midat rachamim. Beit Shammai is an idealist. Beit Shammai looks at the world the way it should be. Halacha should reflect the idealized reality of what the world could have been. And therefore, he follows the Midat HaDin. Beit Hillel looks at the imperfect actualization of human frailty and follows Midat HaRachamim. That's why the Arizal writes, in Yemot HaMashiach, when the world will be in a perfect state, the halacha will be Beit Shammai, because that is the idea. So, if you look at it this way, this is what Dasmani Tatlov 7 says, that Beit Shammai looks at potentiality, and Beit Hillel looks at the imperfect actualization of that potential. That's exactly the story here. Beit Shammai looks at a miracle in terms of the divine potentiality God put into the oil. Day one, God put 8 days of burning power into that oil, even though we didn't know it at the time. Day two, it diminished to 7. Potentiality diminishes. Beit Hillel focuses on actualization. Right? The actualization, the perception of the reality, increases, even though the potentiality decreases. So Rav Zevin actually connects that machloket to this chumrah and kula. By the way, this explains even another machloket. There's a machloket Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How do you make kiddush on Shabbos? Beit Shammai says, you first make the blessing over Shabbos, for Kadesh HaShabbos, then you say Berei Pri Agafen. Beit Hillel says Berei Pri Agafen, then Mekadesh HaShabbos. How is that connected to anything? So Rav Zevin says the same idea. He says, the question is, we all know that we celebrate Shabbat in very physical ways. We drink wine, we have cholent, we eat, we have a beautiful table. But what is the relationship between the spirituality of Shabbat and the physicality of Shabbat? An idealist would say, I am so elevated by the spiritual holiness that I want to celebrate. Meaning, I'm drinking wine and eating cholent to celebrate the tremendous ruchniyat that I feel. That's how an idealist would look at it. And that's why Beit Shammai says, from the Kedusha of Shabbat, you go to the wine. First, Mekadesh Shabbat, then I go to the wine. Beit Hillel is being a realist. Well, listen, maybe ideally, it's the Shabbat that should lead us to the wine, but sometimes it's the wine that gets us into the spirit of Shabbat. Meaning to say, sometimes it's the cholent that makes me feel the Shabbat instead of, I feel Shabbat, so I'm eating the cholent, right? So even that machloket is a reflection of that same idea. By the way, I saw a 180-degree opposite interpretation in which Beit Shammai is the realist and Beit Hillel is the idealist. Some say this way. Some want to say that Beit Shammai is describing the enthusiasm by which we greet a holiday. That enthusiasms tend to be greatest at the beginning, and then they peter out. So first day of Chanukah, so excited, but never we kind of lose the energy. Beit Hillel is being the idealist, you build it up. So it's actually 180 degrees opposite. Okay. But we now come to the second interpretation of the Gemara that I already alluded to. Beit Shammai says, we want to correspond to the bulls of Sukkot. Beit Hillel says, Ma'alin Bakodesh. Well, Beit Hillel, we understand. You go up in holiness. That seems to be pretty clear. But what's Beit Shammai's connection to Sukkot? So I mentioned historically the connection might be Maccabees too. But the Sfat Emes suggests another interpretation. He says the following. We know that a human soul is compared to a candle. Pasuk in Mishlei, Ner Hashem, Nishmat Adam. That's why we light a Yortzeit candle, Shiva candle. He points out from his grandfather, the Chiddushi Harim, that even the word nefesh, soul, is Rashi Tevos. Ner, which means a receptacle, Ner, Pitzilah, wick, Shemen, oil. What is a human being? We make ourselves a candle to be Makabel,
the light of Hashem, the light of the Shechina, the light of the Torah. But our job is to make ourselves a candle by refining ourselves, by purifying ourselves, by making ourselves worthy to receive the divine light. So says the Sfat Emes, when you're looking at the Nerot of Hanukkah, you're looking at a mirror of your soul. You're looking at yourself. You're looking at the radiance of your neshama. So now, the machlokas beishamei and beisarel is, how do you purify yourself to receive the godly light? Beishamei uses the metaphor of fire as that which burns and destroys. Meaning beishamei says, now David HaMelech says, sor meira, turn away from evil. V'yaseh tov, and do good. Beit Shammai says, spiritual perfection requires that you look at yourself objectively and honestly. You identify the evil or the negativity within you, and you burn it away. Anger, arrogance, laziness, whatever it might be, Lashon Hara. And I confront it, and I acknowledge it, and I burn it away. Eish, soreif u'machaleh et hara. Based on that model of spiritual growth, might call the Musar model of spiritual growth, obviously the hope is going to be you'll have less and less to do as time goes on. Meaning, I start off with 10, you know, 8 bad things, I work on it, like refining metal. Right? There's less and less impurities that you have to remove. That is Beit Shammai's model of Eish, that is Soref u'mechalek. And therefore you're pochet b'chol. But here too, so why is that connected to Parei Achad? Because like this, Parei Achad adds up to 70 bulls. And the Gemara says that the 70 bulls are keneged the umot ha'olam that tried to destroy us. And the Vilna Gaon explains that the reason they diminish is that symbolizes the weakening of the powers of evil through these korbanot. So the connection is, as Sfat Emes says, the same way the Parei Achad symbolizes the reduction of the powers of evil that are external to me, the Nerot of Hanukkah are the reduction of the powers of evil that are internal to me. Why does Beis Hillel disagree? Because once again, Beis Hillel is the realist. He says to Beit Shammai, essentially, which is not a he, it's a school, Beit Shammai, they basically say the following. You know, you're right, Beit Shammai. Ideally, I should look into myself, and if I see any ugliness, I work on it, and I get rid of it. But the reality of life is that when we focus too much on our shortcomings and our flaws, we get depressed, we get immobilized, we get paralyzed, we get stuck in a place that I can't pull myself out. And thus, Beis Hillel advocates a spiritual growth model that is not based on looking at your cheschonots and burning them away, but identifying your spiritual strengths and intensifying them. Fire, not as a metaphor for that which destroys, but fire as a metaphor for light and warmth. And Beis Hillel basically says, you dispel the darkness not by attacking the darkness. You dispel the darkness by generating light. And once again, this is also a realist versus idealist situation, because it may very well be that the great tzaddik who is firm and strong can even look into the negatives and attack them and work with them. But practically, for many people, that's not the best way of working. So this is how the Sfasim, you might even say, again, this is a stereotype and an oversimplification, but this might be a machloket in Musar and Chassidus, right? Mm-hmm. That the Musar tends to emphasize focusing on everything that's wrong with me and trying to make it better. And the Chassidus tries to focus on what is positive within me, and by strengthening that positive aspect, the choshech gets diminished automatically. And the halacha is like Beis Hillel. So just want to wish everybody a very, very happy and joyous Hanukkah, and may it be a source of light for all of us.
Thank you. you, everyone. Please feel free to switch around. Talk about the voice too. Okay, if you have
a case, this is not mentioned in
the... I'm sorry, did you use the phone? Did you record this?
Record. I'm going to record this answer if you don't mind. The mention of the base of Hanukkah and the Hashmirayim 1 has been a source for the Maskilim who started attacking traditional Judaism. And they said, here, look, it's not even mentioned in one of the more contemporary works.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts basically were that, I believe it happened because I'll record it, but it was a miracle that was only known and perceived by a small group of people. And as the Maral says, it is not the reason for a Yom Tov. And in perspective, it essentially was just the message that God is giving them, that they should persevere in their fight. But the Nes of Hanukkah is the Nes of Nitzachon. You know, that's not a full answer, because L'maisa, there are other miracles mentioned in the books of the Maccabees. But I think it's really more of, we would say it's a question of emphasis.
Emphasis
of what was, in other words, when they enacted the holiday of Hanukkah, they did not enact it because of the Nes of the Pachashim. That's a good question. The Mefarshim asked that question. So someone says, although the Chara seems to be almost an irrelevant detail, that it's not referring to the mitzvah of the menorah. It's referring that as part of the Simcha of dedication, just like Simcha Spesa Shoeva.
Right.
They had big torches and bonfires, so it's simply describing the joy of that rededication of the Beis HaMikdash.
Right, so nothing to do with that.
So it's not even mentioned in the Menorah at all.
Right, so and they only emphasize the saving of life.
That's right.
Wonderful.